And welcome back to another episode of the On Coaching Podcast. I'm Steve Magnus, joined as always by my good friend and colleague, Jonathan Marcus. John, what's going on, my man?
Steve, the coffee's hot, the sun is shining, and we're back, baby, to give the people what they want. Let's go!
All right, the energy is there. It's the morning. We're recording this.
It's spring in Oregon. We actually finally saw the sun after 4 months of hibernation. I'm like, oh, what is this delicious thing from the sky that's giving warmth and brightness to the universe? I know you see it all the time in Texas, but we it takes a break up here in the Northwest, bro.
Yeah, the sun has come out. All right, that means we need the energy. And this week, we've got a wonderful topic, the science of overuse injuries and rehabilitation for distance runners. Oh, man, we're going to dive into, one of the major problems that we all face in coaching, the injury bug.
That's all we do, man. We talk about problems on this podcast. We could rename it the problems associated with coaching and training distance runners. I feel like because it's the stuff no one teaches you in the coaching ed classes, right? It's like how you deal with all these issues. Like it's not just get a tissue. There's other things involved.
That's right. And you know, one of my favorite things to help deal with problems, a thing that we do as well, you go to your colleagues. You go ask others. The brain trust. And you know what? That's why we built the scholar program to be the brain trust, where you can join hundreds, literally hundreds and hundreds of other coaches.
And I was thinking about this the other day, like how much years of experience do we think is on the Scholar Clubhouse with all 700 plus coaches that we have? I was like, is it like 50,000 years of experience, 10,000 years of experience? It's a lot of years of collective experience, right? And why would you not leverage that and use it?
I don't want to do the math, John.
It's
a big number, but I think, you know, that's also,
and just getting bigger, right? Also, every time someone joins, that's another, whatever, you know, several years of experience on the table.
There it is. And you know, it's an accelerator. I've had coaches from the scholar program, you know, message me, text me, ask me questions, but more so as well, every month we get together on a Zoom and for hour and a half and 2 hours, what do? We talk and solve problems. You know, this isn't just like John and I shouting at you. It is like, hey, let's have a discussion. Let's leverage everybody's information. Let's go deep on topics and solve problems. So if you want to learn more, if you want to problem solve, you know where to go.
Right. I mean, that's the thing, right? We live now in the information age, and this is the information economy. And the best resource and asset is your peers and colleagues. And thankfully, we have tools to make it so we can have these dialogues in place and not just shouting matches that happen on other platforms where it's the price of entry is free. Here, it's just a couple bucks, you know, actually not even as like a dollar and a nickel a day or something like that. And you get access to not only a variety of courses, but also a variety of perspectives and a variety of expertise and a variety of, you know, amazing minds out there in the coaching world. So if you haven't, join up. It's the best accelerator we know of.
Absolutely. All right. So let's get into today's topic, the science of overuse injuries and rehabilitation for distance runners. All right. I'm going to set this up because way back in grad school, actually, here's the story. I was all set to do my thesis on periodization and distance runners, and I was getting most of it done, blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, because, you know, I had that job offer from Nike.
The golden handcuffs, baby. Let's go.
The golden handcuffs. I had to graduate early. I had to finish them up. So what did I do in my last semester? A, I took more classes, and then B, I changed to overuse injuries and specifically stress fractures in distance runners. And we went down this rabbit hole of unpacking things. I think I actually have a published paper on stress fracture prevention in distance runners. So this has taken me back because, you know, why did I switch to that? A, we had a lot of expertise from the faculty there. But B, I'm like, this is the topic, man. We can talk about periodization. That's more interesting to me, you know, because I'm like science nerd, coach training up. But when rubber hits the road, what prevents us from reaching our potential? It's almost inevitably the overuse injuries. So let's unpack it here. I think, you know, when it comes to overuse injuries, we can simplify. And in fact, the bone, when we look at bone overuse injuries, there's this wonderful simple law that is Wolf's Law, which is essentially says that the bone will adapt to the degree of mechanical loading that it's pushed under until like that imbalance occurs, where the loading and the adaptation, meaning the rebuilding of the bone, gets out of whack. And when we look at overuse injuries in the bone, what are they? They're when that loading gets out of whack. Or to simplify even more, it's when stress plus rest is out of whack, when we don't have that balance. And when we look at tendons, muscles, ligaments, although it's a little more complicated, it's often the same thing when we look at overuse injuries, is the load placed on the muscle, tendon, you know, ligaments, all of that stuff gets disproportionately where we can't handle, recover, and repair on that load.
I think, go ahead, finish it.
No, you're good. Go for it.
Yeah, and I think this is what is really important, is we forget that a lot of times with overuse injuries in distance running, because the non-contact repetitive sport, it actually is misuse of tissues injury. And what do I mean by that? This is why I become such a advocate, an enthusiast for trying to teach distance runners biomechanically sound ways to move, using wickets, using other, you know, technical teaching tools for form and technique. Because what often happens is, especially when we're talking about bone and, you know, lower limb bone related injury, like in the tibia, fibia, or in the foot, a lot of times it's because the muscle is overactivated because the mechanical solution an athlete has chosen to create propulsion, or run, as we call it, is not viable for the long term, because it's creates overactivation in smaller muscle groups like the calf complex, and you don't have the degree of activation or inclusion of the bigger muscle groups, right, in the posterior chain, like the glutes or the hamstrings or all these types of things that you hear very commonly. And so what happens is the body will create a movement solution, and it'll go to a movement solution that is successful. But something that's successful in the short term, like using the calf a lot to create propulsion to, you know, get the lower shank off the ground out of stance phase, can then lead to this overuse or misuse of that muscle, creates chronic tightness, right? Chronic restrictions, which then creates chronic pulling on the bone, which then creates a stress fracture. And as someone who had 6 stress fractures, finally, when I figured out that was the root cause, it was like, I run like a dum-dum and I need to fix how I run. Like, great. And never a stress fracture, never, you know, an Achilles thing, never a lower use limb thing after that. But it took about a good 8 years in high school and college of going through this cycle of, yes, having a successful movement solution that got me certain times, that got me certain places, that got me recruited to college, but ultimately led to a dead end, you know, season after season of the same destination, which was a stress stress-related bone injury. And I, at a certain point in my sophomore year of college, I was like, this isn't working. I need to figure out a better way to like move to like, you know, not go down this path and go to the same dead end every time. And that's what led me to this lifelong, you know, curiosity and journey into biomechanics for distance runners.
Yeah, that's interesting, John, because it really is. It's kind of like something will always become the weak link in the chain, right? Especially if we're using stuff in a manner that it, maybe it's not optimal to be used. And generally, the body, we should step back here. The body is a wonderful, like, movement solution generator, right? If and we know this, right? If you have someone who has a little bit of pain, let's say in their Achilles, what do? They change their mechanics a little to take the load off the Achilles. Like, you can watch people do this. You can watch the people with chronic or who have long-term Achilles issues. They'll change how they load the calf. They'll transfer essentially more of the load up the chain to the calf, and soleus and other things, instead of just like straight on to the lower Achilles tendon to take more of the load. This is how the body works. The problem becomes, and this is where we often get these overuse injuries, is if we're using suboptimal strategies, suboptimal mechanics, and we're shifting that load, what happens is we shift that load away from the tendons, muscles that can handle it to a degree, and we're shifting it to muscles, tendons that can handle it in the short term, but over the long term are probably going to end up breaking, not able to handle it, right? And this is also the pattern when you get people stuck in the injury pattern. What happens? It's a pattern of compensation, 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 until you're so far away from the kind of baseline mechanics on how to run, how to do things, that there's like no digging your hole, getting out of that hole, unless you kind of rewire the mechanics and reteach how to use, how to run in a way that you use the muscle tendon units properly.
And this is the big misnomer, right? Is we often think overuse injuries in distance runners, and we're talking about some of the chronic ones that we see with regularity, right? Sore calves that leads to shin splints, Achilles tendinopathy or tendonitis or strains, plantar fasciitis, stuff that happens like basically below the knee. And then also too, like the bigger ones, right? That might be, in the femur or femoral head, like in the hip joint itself for limited range of motion. When you get those femoral head stress reactions or stress fractures, we often think it's just structural or it has to do with the tissues, whether it's the harder tissues like the bone, the more, softer tissues like the muscles, or the more tensile tissues like tendons and ligaments. But really also at the end of the day, there is the neural component, the brain component that Steve was just talking about, right? And that's where we often forget lies the source of the problem, because the brain is just creating a solution to a problem. And we call it a movement solution. And this is where ecological design and constraint-led approach and all these types of theories come into play of just achieving the tasks that you are motivated to achieve, which is run faster on the track or cross-country course or, the marathon course, right? And if you have a poor movement solution, a poor physical literacy index, you're going to create a poor solution to that movement that is, one, suboptimal, as Steve said, and two, not sustainable for the long term, that will lead to some type of self-inflicted chronic overuse injury. So this is where reteaching the brain, that brain, nerve, muscle connection is so vital. This is why physical therapy works. This is why physical therapy is a form of rehabilitation. It's a form of retraining, not only that brain, nerve, muscle connection. And my wife's a physical therapist, right? Like, we know this stuff is important. And this is why we're seeing even, like, say, with hamstring strains and tears, why in recent years, the protocol has been from just resting it for 6 weeks before you load it, to immediately start loading it, within a 48-hour period, to get that brain nerve muscle connection retrained in a way that allows for you to have a better movement solution and have better physical literacy. So when you come back, and this is what's so tough, right, is sometimes there's protocols in place or people who, practitioners who are operating over, with the older, easier model that it's just tissue or structure related and not neurologic related. And that neural component, that physical literacy component, is really important.
This really struck me, gosh, this was almost a decade ago, but I went to Vern Gambetta's wonderful GAIN conference, and I forget the name of the presenter. I should know this, but I'm blanking on it. But he gave this wonderful presentation. He was talking about injuries in more in sports like soccer, but it said the ACL, like an ACL injury is a brain injury. And then he presented all this data to back it up. And we've had even more data. And what it essentially shows is we're used to thinking, as you said there, we're used to thinking of things at the tissue level. But the tissue can repair and the brain injury is still there. What do I mean by that? The way your brain recruits that muscle and those are around it shifts. In fact, there was a recent study on ACL where they did, you know, some brain imaging stuff where the researchers, you know, found that the essentially the nerve pathway that goes from connect from brain to muscle had atrophied, right? And the analogy they used in the study was it was like if you went from a three lane highway down to a one lane highway, you know? And when you do that, you can repair the muscle, you can strengthen the muscle, you can get everything around that you know, ACL to function better, but it's still gonna not function optimally, not have the strength component, not have the stability component, because that pathway, that brain pathway from brain to muscle is still atrophied. And I think getting to your point, that's where the old model of saying take care of the tissue, you know, rest, ice, elevate, all that stuff, that's tissue focused. And yes, we have to worry about the tissue, but it ignores this whole other component, which is neurologically focused, which is what sends the message. And the other thing that I think we should look at this is our brain is smart and it's predictive. So we know if it feels pain, right? Our brain learns, like, don't do that.
You know? Very simple. Like, it's bad.
It's bad. Me no like. This is painful. Don't do this. Like, find another way. Like, don't touch the stove. Whatever it is, right? I don't like. The same thing happens when there's pain inside your body. Your brain goes, yeah, this kind of sucks. Like, don't recruit this area. Don't do this, you know? And what happens is we have to essentially convince it that it's okay. That it's like, I get it. Right now it's a little dodgy, but we can't like shut down the highway and go to road construction here so that we just back up the traffic because it will be much, much, much worse. And I think, you know, going back to that game presentation, what he made the, you know, observation and showed was exactly what you just highlighted there, John, which is like his protocol for ACL after repairs, surgical repairs, was getting people moving very quickly and not just moving in one direction, but doing exercises that, you know, moved in as many planes as possible. And his point was, yes, you let the person and their feedback and even their pain guide things, but there are so many options for movement that if you just start that process, you keep that highway open to a degree. And that's what often when we look at overuse injuries, that's often what happens. I mentioned getting stuck in the injury, you know, rabbit hole of just not coming out of it. A lot of that is because the tissue is repaired. We've recovered, we've strengthened, we've done our little rehab exercises. But the brain is still on high alert. And I've experienced this myself. We all have. After you strain a muscle, let's say you strain your hamstring, even consciously, you're hyper aware of it, right? You're like, oh, was that a little twinge? Is that my hamstring? What happens to you? And that's because your brain has learned, like, hey, this is an area that brings some pain. So we're going to divert all of our resources to it to react at the slightest hint of danger. And what that does is that keeps you in that injury cycle as well.
Yeah. And that's, I think that's the way I started to reframe it, right? Is literacy, physical literacy and illiteracy. And, you know, what you're explaining, Steve, is exactly this, right? If you only have one you know, way to accomplish a movement task, because it's you over specialized in it, right? And you specialize in that route, right? There's only one way to get to the grocery store, and it's this from your house, right? It's go down this road, go down that road, boom, 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 and that's the only way you go. It becomes more familiar, it becomes quicker, it becomes more efficient. But don't, you know, mistake efficient or the most, you know, efficient path in your mind for the most effective path, right? Because that's what we're looking for, is this blend of efficiency and effectiveness. And also too, this robustness, as people call it, you know, or resiliency, where there's multiple roads to Rome, right? Multiple ways that the brain can recruit tissues to get the same movement solution and also problem solving out of it. And so this is where all the stuff, right, is like Steve likes to call it in the Science of Running book, or, you know, on this podcast, all the stuff that's not running, medicine ball work, multi-directional work, you know, agility ladders, wickets, the weight room exercises, that general stuff actually is a vehicle towards creating a more robust physical literacy in an athlete, in a distance runner especially, that they don't typically have access to or familiarity to on a regular basis. The problem is, right, we got sold on this concept in distance running literature and popular culture narrative that's all about physiology, double threshold, lactate, all that matters is that. That's it. Just get that good and you got to, and you're going to be real good. And it's not wrong, but it's not the whole story, right? Because that road to getting this metabolic efficiency and metabolic capacity and to a high degree requires a lot of repetition of movements, requires a lot of repetition of, you know, joint angles, recruitment, dynamic stability, right? And if you're, you know, to excuse my French, if your shit's off and you then, in, you know, take a path of we're going to do this action tens of thousands of times in a day, day after day, you're going to hit a place, a quick point of, like, you know, breaking that structure or that tissue. But if you take a path of, we're also going to do a lot of general work to twist and turn and move and, you know, just basically keep the resiliency of the tissues, the joint capsules and everything through this, you know, through this wide spectrum or range of motion, then you're setting yourself up for more success because you have a better foundation of literacy and a better quote unquote physical vocabulary from which to work from. Right. And that's what all these activities are about. That's what the Eastern Bloc athletes, that's what all, you know, they figured out with like all this gym work and all this, you know, Russian intervals, like we talked about doing running and then doing other, you know, types of movement activities that are really high intensity for short periods and combining them. That's why it works during the general prep period. And that's why it's so important to always keep it a little bit in the programming, even as you get to the more specialized or, you know, championship periods of development, because again, it's part of the basic physical literacies, ABCs, right? And when we think about it like that, we go, oh, okay, now we can contextualize how we create programming better in general for distance athletes, where it's not just let's focus on mileage and running, but let's also make sure we're doing things in the weight room, medicine ball work, plyometric work. And again, it doesn't take a whole lot of loading because the brain, we have to remember, we are hardwired to learn and learn very rapidly. That is one of the talents of Homo sapiens, is we learn quickly about things. Like, don't touch the stove. Takes one time to do that. Like, it's not like, it takes 15 times of burning my hand to go, oh, I'm probably stop touching this. Like, yep, that's a bad idea. We'll never do that again. I mean, so the exposure you give your athletes, especially if you're at the high school level, when they're young and the brain's way more permeable and susceptible to this, down the road just creates a lot more robust athletes to then teach the brain to minimize the chance or minimize the likelihood that these chronic and common overuse injuries will manifest.
All right. So let's start with step one. And I think this is what you're getting at, John. Step one is prevention.
Yes.
prevention in the sense that
an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, 100%.
Yeah, there you go. It's, prevention is that we need to create better movers. And I think what you're getting at here is better movers doesn't just mean like optimizing their running mechanics, although, you know, that can play a role. Better movers means giving them a diverse array of options for how they can move, which means like creating physical literacy. So I'm going to use the physiology comparison that kind of drives this home. So one of the reasons, why do marathoners sprint? Why? You know, we're not training for the 100, what have you. From a physiological standpoint, one of the reasons marathoners sprint is just to remind our bodies that we have fast twitch muscle fibers in there, that we can recruit them and use them. And then as Lydiard, you know, and Peter Snell hypothesized and later find out, is that guess what? You know, in the end of the marathon, when your brain is like, hey, we've used up everything, it can call on those muscle fibers to a degree or use their fuel to a degree. Now, are they as efficient as best as those easy to recruit slow twitch fibers that we were using early in the race? No, but because we have this robust fiber pool, we delay fatigue a little bit. Now think of that outside of the physiology, but in terms of this injury mechanics movement, right? If we have a more diverse array of ways to move, a more diverse way of recruiting the muscles, tendons, all that stuff to utilize to move in different planes, we're going to be like that marathoner, which means that once we run out of our running close to out of our glycogen stores and our slow twitch fibers and they're delaying, we don't just say, oh, we're done. We say, hey, we've got some other tools in the toolkit to keep us going in this manner. The same applies to movement. So when it comes to prevention, what are we talking about? All the things that John just mentioned. This is in actuality. So I'll come back to that. What we're looking at is things like med balls. We're looking at the wicket drills that John does. In actuality, what I was going to say is this is where all those kind of warm-up routines and mobility routines matter. It's actually less about warming up for the specific workout, but more about you're utilizing, you know, different ways to move. This is the hurdle drills and hurdle walkovers. Like, yeah, could those be warm-up stuff? Sure. But it's more about providing you this diverse array of ways to move that challenge you in different planes and directions than just kind of running in a straight line was. This is like, you know, Scott Rasko and Alan Webb were masters of this. Is before workouts, we'd have various warm-ups. And I asked him once, it's like, how come our race warm-up is different from these? And he's like, oh, this isn't the warm-up. This is like getting you to move. Uh-huh. Right?
Yeah. Sneaky strength, right? Sneaky.
It's sneaky strength. You do lunges with twists and turns and all these, you know, things in different directions where you're just before easy run and you're like, why, you know, we think, oh, we're just warming up for this a little bit, but it's sneaky strength in different directions. Mm-hmm. And I think the more we can include those in different ways, the better off we are in terms of movement literacy.
I'm smirking and smiling here because, like, you know, Steve, being brilliant and smart as he is, hit the nail on the head. We call it warm up or cool down or whatever, right? And yes, the activation of the physiology is like, yeah, you get a little hotter, sweatier, better range of motion of the tissues and your physiology. But it's like, that's the truth, is we're actually teaching the brain and, you know, taking care of talking in different languages so you have a more robust vocabulary, right? So it's about being multilingual, so to speak, if we're relating it back to our ability to actually, as humans, talk like this, right? So I can speak English, French, Japanese, Spanish, blah, blah, blah. And then that gives you, again, much better global literacy because you have this multilingual capacity in a movement index, right? So like if you come to my practices at Portland State, right, on the track, on, you know, any day of the week, and we're going to do a track session whether it's, you know, physiologically oriented with threshold and lactate type focus work or neurologically oriented with like speed work, what you will see is the same thing every day. It will be, all right, little jogging, not that much. Now we're going to go in and we're going to do agility ladders. And people are like, why are you doing agility ladders? Like, it does, the people call them speed ladders. It's like, they have no trans. I watch these people do these multi-directional movements at a very fast capacity, one foot in, one foot out, bunny hops, single leg hops, backwards hops, jumping jacks, you know, karaoke, like, you know, all these types of things. And we're literally just waking the brain up and then getting the brain in to move limbs very rapidly. Last time I checked, moving a limb very rapidly is what we call speed. And last time I checked, right, that is what we want in track. That's what we want in running, is faster people. So we're doing a general modality, a general application to get the brain moving in a certain multi-directional planar motion to increase physical literacy, to quote unquote wake up, but also to that going kind of lateral movement, right, going backwards movement, habitually, repeatedly over time, allows those tissues to just have a better index or literacy that then minimizes and creates this prevention for overuse injuries. It's not these bullshit half-hearted dynamic warm-up drills that people used to, that people did and were like, oh, these are awesome, these are great. But then it becomes like this, like, we're going to lollygag and like dick around and go real slow and just like basically bullshit our way through it that you see now, right? It's very specific, and there's a time threshold and a time demand on putting your foot and your limbs and your bodies in the right place and right time and space very rapidly that then creates translation. Then next is wickets, right? 8 times through a series of 10 to 14 wickets with a run out of 20 to 30 meters, right? Maintaining kind of that movement solution in the wickets within the constraint and then maintaining it out of the constraint once you get out of the wickets and run on the flat 20 to 40 meters. Now we are actually, all right, prepared to do the workout. And then, you know, the warm up is, all right, we're going to do 4 times 100 progressive. And here we are. Now we've come to a space where we're physiologically warmed up, but also, too, we have snuck in some preventative strength work before we actually do the specific work. And then we go do the specific workout, whatever it may be. And afterwards, right, we then cool down with fresh runs and hurdle mobility, and then we finally get our cool down jog in, right? So the hurdle mobility, going through, again, ranges of motion, slower movements now, because why? We're fatigued. We've used up glycogen. We've used up our neural capacity because we did a hard training session that was specific to our event group. So, but then this is bigger range of motions, slower. And typically on those workout days, we will also go in the weight room afterwards, right? So now we're in the weight room after we worked out. Physiologically, we're in a compromised state, but what are we doing in the weight room? Medicine ball work that Steve describes, you know, lunges and twists, Bulgarian split squat movements, deadlifts, slower relative to the speed work we just did or the faster running we did, but through a wide range of motions in the joints and tissue capsules that over time progressively will act as a safeguard towards those types of overuse loading injuries that are so chronic in distance runners, right? So it's not about getting strong in the weight room and lifting the most weight possible, right? I'm not a fan of just moving weight to move weight. It's move it well with the right mechanics and, you know, kind of find that happy tension where it's like moderately difficult, but you're not rounding your back in a deadlift and trying to lift it with the upper body. You actually learn how to hinge from the hips, right? Where the pelvis moves, you know, kind of backwards rather than up and down versus this kind of like, you know, Bulgarian deadlift, which is like half a squat, half a deadlift. It's like understand what's the difference there. And two, if we're going to squat, right, making sure like, okay, we got a lot of distance runners who typically have limited mobility in ankle joints. So we can get a wedge plate or for which to stand, like 10 degrees, 20 degrees, what have you. So they can go down and up through a full range of motion. Again, flossing essentially, right, from a structural capacity with the tendons, ligaments, and muscle and fascial tissue, that hip capsule, so that we maintain good biomechanics and also minimize the ability to get overuse. Like, but it's, we tend to think of it as work, but as Steve has eloquently pointed out, It's just sneaky work that helps us prevent overuse injuries.
You know, it reminds me of what Vern Gambetta, I'll quote him again, said to me once, which is, if you look at guys like Peter Snell and the Lydiard days, why did Lydiard not have to do as much strength work and all that stuff? Because he was getting guys who grew up in the 50s and 60s who like had to do stuff, right? It's the old like farm boy strength.
Yeah. Right? I mean, look at Percy Seri at Portsea, right? It's like, they were doing like all this farm work and then also like lifting. And it's like, oh yeah, Herb Elliott's a man child. Like, well, let's go.
Right. And I think that it's not like, I think what we've done is we've made everything into like work. And what we're really looking for is developing just overall people who can, you know, move in a way that maybe they didn't get because they grew up in the 2020s or 2010s. And this is the life we kind of live in. So we're trying to replicate that.
And that's what I look for, like recruiting student athletes nowadays. It's like, oh, you are a multi-sport athlete. You played basketball, volleyball, and then you did track in the spring. You didn't run cross country. Great. Why? That was the only saving grace I had as a student athlete. Was I was a 5-sport varsity athlete, basketball, swimming, soccer, and then, you know, and then finally track and cross country. But I don't think I would have, and I also cycled a lot too, because I was on, you know, high school cycle team or whatever. So I'm out there moving all the time. Basically, that's if I'm not in the classroom, I'm doing sport and I was playing, right? I wasn't a screen kid that much. I mean, yeah, I played some video games, but not that much. And that's what gave me a shot, was the fact that I was just out there just moving a bunch. And I think we forget how important it is at a young age to have the exploration of movement be a thing where it's not just towards a competitive outcome like you have with all these club sports now or AAU sports where it's like, we got to win right away. And because what happens is to win, to compete, we always rely on our strength. And it might not be the best physical literacy of what our strength movement is to get that victory. But as we age and we get older, that strength that behooved us and gave us victory when we were younger might not be the most efficient pathway. It might create a ceiling and a cap, right? That no longer, as our peers advance and get more mature or get better, allows us to get victory over them. So then you have to eventually go all the way back to zero and reteach yourself how to move in a more effective and efficient pathway to then be able to keep pace with your peers as they start to mature and grow and find better movement solutions later on in life. And this is why long-term athlete development is so important and why we see a lot of great professional athletes and a lot of great, you know, world-class athletes come to the sport late, come to specializing late, 18, 19, 20 year old, instead of at 8 or 10 year olds, as we see a lot more happening in the social media driven era.
Exactly. I mean, that's what it is. And what I would recommend from a practical standpoint, and one of my favorite things to do as a coach was during, you know, before cross country season, we had our kind of preseason camp a couple days. I would watch the kids play ultimate frisbee or soccer or whatever have you. And that gives you a really good idea of like who are the diverse movers and who needs some work, you know, and that gives you some background on that. So look for that. And that, in fact, sometimes I think for high school athletes, especially, is like instituting games is one of the best things that you can do. Yes, it's not training, but it's kind of unofficial training. It gets to back to, we don't have to overschedule things. Go throw a frisbee out there, go throw a football out there or soccer ball or whatever have you out there during preseason camp or during the, you know, during, you know, down weeks in the season and see how people move and allow them to move. And that's creating that physical literacy. All right, John. So we've talked a lot about prevention. What I want to get now, because we outlined this at the beginning, is what do you do when you get stuck in these overuse injury cycles and you have to rehab? The old model, as we kind of, you know, stated, you know, take a long time, rest, ice, you know, and then start doing like very simple exercises to target that tissue. And then after a long, long journey back, you introduce running and blah, blah, blah. What would you say again? I know we're talking in generalities here, but how would you direct the rehab or getting out of that overuse cycle for athletes now?
First, okay, sorry, off mute. First is the pain thing. Everyone's interpretation of pain is different. People have different sensitivities to pain. So we have to be aware that pain is a safeguard mechanism that first needs to be overcome and addressed and deal with. So you have to find modalities or activities that are not painful in a flight type sense, right? And so that is key. Is this is not easy. This is not cookie cutter. It makes it really tough because each individual has, again, a different, unique interpretation of that. So first is like getting that squared away about the degree of pain you're dealing with this overuse injury. And then too, it's about how do we build scaffolding as best we can, whether it's all on you as the coach or in partnership with kind of a sports medicine practitioner or multiple practitioners to create a pathway back towards, moving without pain first and then moving better without pain. So I think that's the first, the protocols that I use is like, first we have to minimize the pain sensitivity that might be happening here. Figure out we can use isolative exercises and rehab, which are very common, but eventually we want to accelerate as best we can to whole movement patterns where the entire body is working as one chain or one unitary whole versus these isolative, okay, just strengthen the calf with, calf pull, eccentric calf, lowering or calf raises or things like that. We want to get things working in a holistic chain. And that's where you want to think of holistic movement patterns as the eventual end destination. But to get out of the mud, so to speak, get unstuck, we might have to start here with more isolative exercises that address the structural deficiency in the tissue that are very common. But then as soon as possible, as responsibly as possible, get to a place where we're moving holistically.
Absolutely. I think it's like, how do you get to movement in an appropriate manner quickly? And it comes back to that brain injury. And I would look at it as you kind of pointed out, is like pain is your guide, but it's like, what is the movement we can get up to the line where we're moving pain free, but in a manner that, gets us, is like progressing us towards the thing. I think it's less protection orientated and more like approach orientated, where we're saying, okay, like let's kind of test the skills and see what happens. And actually I remember doing this both as a coach and an athlete, especially after things like hamstring strains, we'd look at, okay, what's the slowest movement we can do? That might mean walking first. But then it could mean jogging. And I remember like we would not press it, but we'd try and get athletes up to where it's like, okay, maybe their hamstring starts to feel a tiny bit of pain at 15 second hundreds. Well, we do 16 or 17 second hundreds and you're getting big rest in between, but you're kind of pushing that of like, let's get our body to remind ourselves what is normal in this activity that we're doing.
And oftentimes too, right? The first line, if we go back, okay, injury occurs, something like that. The first line of defense is ultimately, going to be a little bit of rest from the injury inducing movement pattern. So whatever the movement pattern that induced that overuse injury or chronic overuse injury is, we want to rest or not do it. So a lot of times that's running in the way they're running. And the next step, right? So is minimizing the exposure to the injury-inducing movement pattern. And then two, immediately is body work, right? Getting some type of body work. Now, this could be the massage gun, this could be foam rolling, but what happens, right, is oftentimes this body work is applied haphazardly and kind of randomly on a whim or in a disordered way. And this is really important. It's the same thing that happens like with nutrition and anything is the law of entropy is really important to understand. Everything will devolve to chaos unless you exert an ungodly amount of energy and focus to make things non-chaotic. And, you know, we have essentially a spectrum that I look at, Steve, right? We have dysfunctional, disordered, and ordered, right? So think of it, dysfunctional movement pattern, disordered movement pattern, and ordered movement pattern. And we look at this spectrum, we have to say, okay, where on the spectrum is this athlete sitting with their movement solutions? Is it just holistically dysfunctional? Like things are off, things are firing, you know, in a way that just makes no sense. They have these compensation patterns because one side of the chain's on, one side of the chain's off, what have you. Disorder is like, well, all right, disordered means it's not the best way to do it. It's not the most, it's suboptimal, as Steve would say, but it works because you are crossing the finish line 9 times out of 10 ahead of someone else. So we're not going to screw it up, but you know, you get little niggles, you take some time away, you come back, right? And ordered is like, man, this person just moves really well. They're a movement god or goddess, like no overuse injuries. It's amazing. And that's eventually, right, the Platonian ideal where we want to get people to. So with that in mind, of that spectrum of dysfunctional, disordered, and ordered, is then saying, all right, if the movement solution of running is dysfunctional and disordered, and we need to take time away, part of the re-education pathway is some type of body work in a systematic way, whether it's one, a complete, and oftentimes what we do, right, is we try to say, oh, we're just going to attack this with like random things like massage or needling or, massage gun or foam rolling, but saying, okay, let's actually think of it in more of a systematic way of first things first. Probably when you get a big overuse injury, you just need a complete massage, like 90 minutes on the table, just getting a massage for the whole body, not just attacking the one area. That one area might be problematic and the one that has the most alarm bells going off, but the body works as a unitary whole. So getting a full body massage is what I recommend right off the rip, right? From there, you can then start to incorporate some type of treatment on a regular basis with, the different recovery tools that are out there now, but understanding, right, that massage or even foam rolling or massage guns type stuff does create micro tears in the tissue. And so it's kind of like training. You got to take some time away. You're not going to sit here and massage gun every single day and go, okay, that'll make it better. Like you're still breaking down tissues and breaking up adhesions and doing all this stuff when you apply these recovery, strategies, right? So that's key. Now, if we treat massage and we treat foam rolling and massage gun stuff like training, we say, okay, there's tissue breakdown. What does that mean? Nutrition. You need to then supplement and augment the recovery and repair with good quality nutrition, right? So good macros, good micros, what's necessary to help augment that repair process. So key with the protein, carbs, glucose, etc. Right. So that's why it's such a holistic approach, because the tissue is going to interpret this work done on it with creating breakdown or, adhesions, breakup as training. So we need to address it like we would training by providing good recovery afterwards, hydration, obviously, and sleep. So you can still be an athlete and do athletic things and have an athletic lifestyle, even when you're in the injury cycle or on the shelf with injury, provided you understand like it's part of rebuilding the tissues and repairing it, back more robustly and quickly and soundly, and then going through this. And then from there, right, we go from the addressing it with passive work, good nutrition intake, to then more active work, like Steve said, getting to movement as quickly as possible in a really productive way, but always keeping that athletic mindset and athlete lifestyle in sharp focus. Because what happens a lot of times, if you're not training hard, you tend to start to adapt a more generic population mindset where you're just, all right, I'm staying up till 2 or 3 in the morning, or I'm eating Cheetos and Doritos and junk food. And you forget, like, that's actually when you're injured or when an athlete is in that overuse injury, initial acute phases of that road to betterment and Road to Health and Repair and Return to Play, that's also like the most important time to still live the athlete lifestyle.
Absolutely. I mean, I think you summed it up really well there, is that it really is about, like, not just, hey, let's take care of this tissue in this kind of small view, but it's like holistically. It's like, yes, the tissue matters, but also the lifestyle, the nutrition, are we supporting? Do we then bring in the movement pattern for the brain, the neurological, all that stuff? And I think it's not to say that, like, hey, ignore the tissue. It's branching out and seeing things holistically, instead of through a narrow range of like, oh, we've just got to let the strain recover or the bone heal, and then we'll be okay. You know, we've talked a lot about muscles and tendons, but it's similar in the sense of the bone loading as well. As we can't just say, oh, it's healed, like, go back and do the same thing. We know if we do the same thing, we know that bone, like, didn't have the right balance of stress and adaptation. And if we just keep loading in the same way, things aren't gonna end well. And often the bone injuries have to relate to what the muscle is doing around it to absorb force, and on and on and on. So the whole takeaway for this podcast, John, is, I think, is zoom out and see things holistically. And if you do that, you're going to be in a much better place than if you just say, oh, like, we need to tackle and let this thing, or try to get this thing to heal, and don't handle what's surrounding it and don't support what's surrounding it. Because if you don't, then you just end up in that cycle all over again.
Yeah, it's short-term thinking versus a long-term approach. And too often, right, we fall into the Band-Aid, mindset of, great, get more cushy shoes, put a compression sleeve on it, right? All these little, like, quote-unquote hacks or products you can buy, when at the end of the day, we were designed through evolution to run barefoot with nothing and do it really for long periods of time, you know, on a multitude of variety of different surfaces, right? So it's like, why do we need all of a sudden in this modern era, all these different little, like, you know, tricks or hacks and things you need to buy essentially from a consumer standpoint to make us better, when the body itself is an adaptive, self-healing, self-regenerative mechanism, provided the right elements are consistently incorporated into its daily rhythm. And that's the key part, right? Is when we look at the science of overuse injuries and rehabilitation, what happens is we often take a Frankenstein or a part approach versus, you know, going part whole, where we just look at the part that needs repair. And then we say, we're going to do all these things in an isolated manner for 15 minutes a day. And, you know, day after day, and yeah, we'll get a little bit better, because the body, like we said about, when you no longer do the thing that makes it get hurt and you ignore it or you rest from it, it will then self regenerate. But at the same token too, it's about being honest and holistic, or being honest with your approach to really identify, is it holistic or is it fractioned? And when we look at the, you know, need to move beyond a fraction approach to a holistic approach, yeah, it's more complex. There's more layers to it. It's juicier, but it's an opportunity to lean in. And sometimes really simple interventions, right? Especially with more remedial athletes or younger athletes, is just something as simple as sleep. Like, are you sleeping consistently? I was telling Steve, like, offline before we started here, quick tangent, you know, we're in the thorns of dead week and finals week here for spring, winter term before spring term. But we're just starting outdoor track season. And all of a sudden, a group of really durable, you know, student athletes who were like feeling good, you know, and this is when the weather was also crappier too, rainy and colder and no sun. And now it's like sunny and 70. And like, we should be feeling really good, right? Because the weather is now a lot better. And we've been doing quality training, progressive training, intelligent training. All of a sudden, we're having a lot more, you know, aches and pains and niggles. Oh, my hamstring. Oh, my calf. Oh, this. Like, can you still work? Yeah, but it's just kind of tender and sore. And I go, what changed, right? And what changed was everyone got really stressed out because I have this big multiple tasks of finals or projects for several classes that is due within a very short time constraint of 2 to 3 weeks. And oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, it's worth this much my grade. This is that, like the alarm bells and cortisol are through the roof, right? And so they're not recovering. And so they're not getting enough sleep. They're not getting enough hydration because they're focused and stressed out about these tasks. So what do we do in training? Great. More days off. Great. Okay. Hey, everyone, you're going to have 3 days off this week or on your own activity, general work, just some light work. Like I even had like a student athlete come to the track, and we had this like speed time trial plus fast 150s and aerobic support with repeat Ks at threshold plan. And he was just like, I don't know, coach, I feel really weak. I just feel really, really tired. I go, hey, let's just go through the warm up, see how you feel. And we'll just check in rep by rep, step by step. Okay. He goes through his warm up. Do you feel like you could do the 200 meter time trial where you just, let's see how fast you can run 200 meters. Okay. I can do that, coach. Great. And then it's like, all right, you did it. Okay. How you feel? Maybe that's it. We're done. You did a fast 200 meter. That was awesome. You're on 23.8. Cool. Good for you. You know, speedy enough for my means. If you need to go back to sleep or go focus on your studies, go do that. Actually, I woke up, coach. Okay, great. Hey, why don't you try 150s with the group instead of like sprinting it all out? Like it was designed to be fast, but you just might not be there. Let's not overload it. And part, one at a time, we go from, I don't know, coach, if I can do the training, I feel really weak and tired and exhausted, to completes the whole training session, completes the weight room session, wakes up, feels a lot better. It's great. But any point along that road in that journey, had he expressed, I'm just not feeling it, coach. I don't feel like myself. I don't feel like I have the oomph or the bang, or I didn't wake up. I've been like, fine. Hey, cut the session and go home. No problem. It's finals week, dead week. I get it. Not worried about it. We have 6 months of quality training behind you. We can have a spotty week of training and you can focus on recovery and rest to make sure that you are ready to go. And this is where we as coaches have to be sensitive to the streets our athletes are walking in, because sometimes it requires crumpling up and tearing up the entire playbook or training plan and just making sure that we don't overdo it when they're in a really delicate state, so that we don't even introduce the thought or possibility of these overuse injuries.
Be willing to pivot. Yeah. You know, be flexible. That's what it's all about. I think you summed it up great there, John. All right, everybody. Well, thanks for listening. We hope you took away some new insights and science on injuries and what to do with them. And until next time, everybody, keep on coaching.